This is the One Thing podcast, where we teach you the surprisingly simple truth behind extraordinary results. My name's Jeff Woods. I'm the vice president here at The One Thing. In the last episode, you got to hear about how Ben Kinney overcame adversity and built his businesses. This is a guy who has achieved an extraordinary level of success. It was a great conversation about overcoming adversity and mindset. Make sure you listen to that one if you have not. In this episode, you are going to meet somebody else who has achieved an extraordinary level of success. This woman is a real estate mogul. She's a millionaire coach. She's created several multi-million dollar businesses, and she's written a pretty awesome book called Falling for Money. So we are going to have a conversation about that exact topic, money, and what it takes, what the actions and the habits are that will define whether or not you end up becoming a millionaire. So with that, let's get into my conversation with Christina Wise.
Eating healthy is an investment. It's an investment in yourself, but it also often requires an investment of your time. But good news is, Factor has delicious, ready-to-eat meals that are ever fresh and never frozen. They're chef-created, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. With Factor, you can choose from a weekly menu of up to 35 options, including popular things like Calorie Smart or Keto Direction or Protein Plus or Vegan and Veggie. Also discover 60 more add-ons every week, like breakfast on the go, lunch snacks, beverages to help you stay fueled, feel good all day. And we know our listeners here at The One Thing are focused on health and health goals. That's why we choose to partner with Factor. And if you visit factormeals.com/150 and use code 150, you can get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. Again, that's factormeals.com/ONE50 and use code ONE50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month.
Your name came up in conversation with Jay Papazan. He's like, you got to meet Christina. You will love Christina. And then we got together for coffee, which was one of my best coffee dates. So that was fun. But one of the things that really blew me away, your mindset around money, your mindset around building true wealth, which I think there is a massive discrepancy on what people consider wealthy these days. Let's talk about that.
I would love to. Money is one of my favorite subjects.
Oh, mine too. So how did the first and foremost, without going too much into the backstory, because I alluded to that in the intro, where did this passion and interest in the study of money and building wealth come from?
Well, I think for most of us, when we have big epiphanies, it comes out of great suffering and or breakdowns. And I started my career in real estate. First of all, I grew up pretty poor. So I'd always had an inclination to want to make money. I think it was built in from a very young age. I was very entrepreneurial, selling like apricots at swap meets to try to make money when I was little. So making money has never been an issue for me. I know that can be an issue for some, but making money's always been pretty easy. I found myself in real estate early on in my career, my late 20s. It's been my first and only career, really. But the great thing about real estate, as you know, is if one applies himself and they have a good work ethic and they take care of their customers and they enjoy sales and some prospecting, you can do well income-wise. And so I made a pretty high income, and this was, you know, I'm aging myself, but 2 decades ago. And this was several hundred thousand dollars a year 2 decades ago, which was a lot of money. And it was especially a lot of money for a 20-something. And it was especially even that much more money for a 20-something who grew up poor. So what I did is I bought everything I couldn't afford as a kid, which was what? Houses, cars, boats, expensive vacations, you name it. And so that all appeared to be working when I was making a good income until I get divorced, life happens, single mom, lost my income and making ability. And then I realized, like, holy cow, I'm $150,000 in debt. I have the IRS knocking on my door because I didn't know how to pay taxes. I just made and spent all my money. So it's really a really low point in my life that of total financial despair and suffering and wondering how I'm going to feed my kids. And it was colleagues at work at Keller Williams who actually paid our light bills for 6 months. It was embarrassing. It was shameful. It really brought up a lot of childhood, you know, feelings of feeling insignificant. And oh my gosh, I'm a charity case again. So it was at that point where I just realized, you know what? I know rich people. I've seen them. there's got to be more to this money thing than making money, because making money is easy. So making money and having net worth or being rich must be totally different. So then I just made it my personal life passion to study money, to study multimillionaires, Gary Keller being one of those, of course. And that became my life study. So, you know, starting there and where I am today. And then after that, after I did well in real estate, and then I had a health crisis, and that health crisis then kind of was a pivot for me even another direction to realize that our body's our number one asset. And if we don't take care of our body, all the money in the world doesn't necessarily matter, whether it's income or net worth. So that's really then taken us to where we are now, where I really have a passion to teach others about money. So hopefully they can avoid some of these breakdowns I've experienced in my life.
Yeah. I'm really curious because as you're talking about that, I have this flashback to when I was in my first job out of college doing copier sales at Xerox, wanting to work so hard to make a good amount of money and being mentored by some of the top executives in the company, looking at their lifestyle, imagining the type of money they made. And I remember one of them on a business trip looking at me and saying, hey, you don't realize one day you're going to make X amount of dollars. And this was an amount of money that I could never have perceived possible to earn. And I remember that thought of, wow, when I just make that much money, I'll be set. Well, my career continues. I get into medical device sales and I end up blowing that number out of the water. What was interesting though, was how I still felt not poor, but cash tight in a certain sense, because I had allowed my standard of living to rise as my income had risen. I didn't understand when you should own a car versus lease a car, just all these different things that now have been beat into my head now that I've had the right mentorship in my world. Why do you think so many people focus on top line income?
Well, because it's obvious. I mean, we've never studied money. When you don't understand money fundamentals, what's common sense and obvious is you make money and you spend money. And there's something called Parkinson's Law that says expenses will always rise to match income on the money side. It applies to the productivity side too. But that's just natural. The more money that we make, it's just natural we spend more. So if we get a $100,000 raise, what do our expenses stay the same? Do we stay in the same house? Do we have the same car? Do we take the same type of vacations? No, we typically upgrade to a bigger house, but it's not a bigger house. It's a bigger house payment. It's not a better car. It's a bigger car payment. It's not a nicer vacation. It's a more expensive vacation payment. So what eats up our income are payments. And people don't really talk about payments or think about payments. And so really, to the science behind net worth and becoming a millionaire or any multiples of is to not have any payments and to just focus on income. So, but that's not common sense. Common sense is like, oh, I made more money. Now I can trade in my Honda for a BMW.
Yeah. It's so easy. It's so easy before you even realize that you have stepped up your standard of living. And man, was it a rude awakening. Because I remember when my income got slashed by 40% and I just suddenly realized it was those payments that kept coming in month after month. It got to the point where I'm almost wondering if we need to sell our house. Part of the reason I started the first podcast and ultimately ended up here, but adjusting that standard of living down has been a real problem for me.
Here's the thing on that, Jeff, is that another Parkinson's law is what was once a luxury becomes a necessity. So for example, remember when navigation systems in cars, that was a luxury, right? Remember the nav in the cars? And I had one of the first cars with the nav and it was such a luxury. Now, navs and cars are necessities. I mean, what car doesn't have one? So we get used to these higher standards of living. And then that becomes, oh, I couldn't imagine having a car that's not a BMW. I couldn't imagine having X, Y, or Z. So we get adjusted very easily to higher standards of living. And as the income creeps up, so does the standard of living. And that just becomes the path. And we're not even paying attention to it because we think we can afford it because we have an income that can pay for our payments. And then there goes on for however many years until typically we bump into a crisis that we don't have the savings or, you know, our income starts to stall out or goes down as we age. And it's at that point, sort of midlife, where we start to realize like, wait a second, I thought I'd be farther along by now. I thought I would be off this paycheck to paycheck roller coaster. I thought I'd have more consistent income in my career by now.
Well, I remember the most powerful lesson of that for me, just that paycheck to paycheck, was when one of the executives in one of my former companies who made a lot of money had a few changes of events in his life. And suddenly, even though he made a lot, he was on the verge of filing for bankruptcy because he had allowed his standard of living. He was way keeping up with the Joneses. Didn't matter if you make $500,000 a year, if your lifestyle is 600 grand a year. I never wanted to get into that position. Yet when I look at the actions that have happened, you know, that standard of living has continually crept up. What do you suggest to the people who are going, all right, you know, I've enjoyed some success. I have not been mindful and holding myself accountable in terms of maintaining a certain standard of living. How do they adjust down? How do they reset?
Yeah, well, it's a lot of it is a mindset issue, and you have to know why. So a lot of what I teach through my money courses, I usually start with sharing what I call the 7 secrets of millionaires. And so there's things where I've studied and really studied these multimillionaires and worked to distill it down, because back when I was in financial crisis, I had this thought that if I could think and act like rich people, would I be rich? Could I be rich? And so when I thought about that, I thought, well, I think of course, right? If I could think like a rich person and then I could learn how to act and turn those actions into habits, like the habits of rich people, why couldn't I become rich? So that was what I started studying at the very beginning. It's like, what are they thinking and doing? What do they know that I don't know? And what are they doing that I'm not doing? And that became that first part of the study. So since then, over a decade of study, and now my own application and realizations from that, is what I've noticed is what I call the 7 secrets that millionaires know that make them rich that you don't, that keep you on the paycheck to paycheck hamster wheel. And so the first thing that millionaires do that I've always, you know, across the board, is they don't focus on how much money they make. Now, your income's an accelerator. So the more money you make, the faster you can get to some, you know, net worth level. But it's not the focus. And so millionaires focus more on what they keep. And it's a keeping game. So part of going back to answer your question is, it's when you understand that it's not about how much money you make, automatically then, if it's about how much money you keep, automatically it's your standard of living is not going to go up, because that's the way millionaires think, right? So then it becomes a keeping game versus an earning game. Versus normal, for most of us, what we're thinking is, oh my God, if I could just make more money, that would save all my problems. So if I earn $50,000 a year, if I could just earn $75,000, that would solve all my problems. If I make 100 and I'm on paycheck to paycheck, if I could just make 150, all my problems would go away. Then you creep up to 150. If I could just make 250, all my problems would go away. And that becomes the cycle. But that's because built in isn't this belief system of, it's not about how much money I make, it's all on the keep side. So it's a different focus. The second thing that I've noticed, sort of a secret of millionaires, is that they don't do what I say the Joneses are doing. So we've all heard, you know, keep up with the Joneses. And many times we think, oh, I'm not a Jones or whatever. But it's so built into our culture, like we're not even aware of it unless we really are working to pay attention to it. And here's some Joneses statistics. So across the board, Joneses, let's say, is the majority of people in North America, by far, a large majority, is that the average family credit card debt is $16,000.
Meaning actual balance that is carried from month to month?
Yes, month to month. So it's a $16,000 average balance. So that may sound like a lot, or to some, it may sound like not much money to others, but it's $16,000 on average. What that boils down to, what that means now, if we take that $16,000, what that means is, based for the, sort of the average payment for credit card companies, it's around a $240 minimum payment. So that's the payment we're making, right? And many times people think, man, I'm getting away with something. I've got $16,000 of debt and it's only costing me $240 a month, and I can more than afford this $240. But this is when we keep looking at what that $240 means, then we look at, okay, how long paying the minimum payment will it take me to pay back the $16,000? Any guesses?
Nah, 20 years.
You're close. It would take 15 years.
Wow.
So 15 years. And how much do you think we're going to pay in total by the time we add on the interest?
Well, I'm about to do it. 240 times 12 times, you said 15?
15 years times a 19% compounded interest. So unless you're using a compounding interest calculator.
No, because without compounding, it's 43 grand.
Right. So you can do the math. So even let's say without compounding, $43,000. So that's like thinking, would you go to a car lot, look at a $16,000 Toyota and say, hey, car salesman, I'll pay you $43,000 for that $16,000 car.
Not a compelling value proposition.
Like, yeah, right. But probably never in our right mind. But that's what we're doing with our credit card companies. But this is where, this is the next piece. That's bad enough. But even the next piece that's broken is that instead of paying what I call the credit card bank, the $40,000 or the $240 a month, if we'd have paid our bank account the $240 a month and compounded it only like an 8%, we would be worth $100,000 at the end of that same 15-year period. So we're making the banks bazillions of dollars by the aggregate of everybody making their $240 payments on the average of $16,000 of debt. And we are robbing our future selves of the $100,000. And that's kind of the tragedy of all this, is that we're robbing our future selves by keeping, by paying all this money to the banks. And it's the credit card bank, the car bank, the mortgage bank, the student loan university bank, or whatever it might be.
Now, here's something interesting, because I remember studying money when I was a kid. My dad handed me Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I remember reading The Automatic or The Millionaire Next Door when I was in high school, probably. And I remember learning the idea of leverage and going, oh, leverage, amazing. And so when I think of, you know, taking a loan out on a car, I go, well, interest is so low, I can do better. Why wouldn't I do that? Where do people go wrong there?
Where they go wrong is not necessarily with the first car. So if you can buy a car, get a low interest rate, and then pay that baby off as quickly as possible. So many times that's a good starting place. The problem is that people don't trade in cars. They trade in car payment for car payment. So what that means is if we take now, let's say our $750 payment, even at a low interest rate, but if we take that $750, which I think that's probably the average lease payment for a real estate agent. but we never pay it off. So then you get the net, you trade in the next car, but you trade in for the next car payment, the next car payment. So just $750 a month for those nice, for the nice BMW payment. At the end of 20 years, had we put that $750 into our bank account, we'd be worth probably $600,000 at a really low 7-8% interest. If we did it for our entire career, most families have one or two car payments their entire sort of adulthood, that would be $5 million of investing that $750 at a just a market rate if we would have not had the car payment. So that's what we're doing, is we're, it's the payment, regardless of the interest rate. If we're using that payment, we're keeping the car bank in business and making them rich, and we're keeping our future self broke. So now if we have a lot of differential, Jeff, and you've got plenty of money that you're shaving off the top and you're investing, and it's enough to hit your millionaire net worth numbers, and you want to have a car payment at low interest rate, then go for it. You know, it's, but most people aren't doing that. They've in this mindset that, oh, it's a low interest rate, I'm going to get this car payment, and then one day when I have more money or I make more money, I'll start to save and invest. But it needs to be flipped the other way around.
Well, the reason I went there is because I found out yesterday that my car got totaled. Lovely. So I now have to go out and get a new car. Well, okay, I can go pay cash for this new car, or interest rates are very low, why not keep it in the bank? Or why not use that money that could have just paid the car cash and actually invest it?
Yeah, and sometimes, so my husband and I were in a very similar situation. So we bought our daughter a new car and for college. And so we were looking at this, and I don't know, it was like a $35,000 car, and we have the cash. And so we looked at that and we thought, same thing, interest rates are so low, so why don't we pay, you know, why don't we get a loan for it? So we actually did in this case, because we're shaving plenty of on the top. And we thought, why would we just take the $35K out of cash and pay payments? But then we looked at where our cash was sitting, and our cash was only making, like, I don't know, 1%. And we're paying 3.5 or 4.5 or whatever we're paying towards the car payment. So we looked at that and thought, well, we're making less money. I mean, we're paying 4.5% for the car, and we would rather just the difference between the 1.5 and 4.5, we're paying more for the car payment than, since we're only getting 1.5 on the cash, it made sense to go ahead and pay cash. But again, so that's what we looked at. We thought, why are we getting this loan? We might as well pay cash for it, because it's costing us more with, even though it's low interest. And so we have to understand that a lot of times you just have to do the math, and I call it millionaire math, and just look at the pro cons, because sort of the common sense or natural inclination is like, oh, interest rates are so low, why don't we just go do it? And we kind of got fooled into that same thing until we're going through all of our tracking during the month and saying, but our cash isn't making any money anyway, and we're pouring more in interest, so why wouldn't we just pay it off?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jay and I were talking about net worth the other day, and we, for our founding members group that we're working with right now, we're trying to identify certain metrics that we want to help people track. And we were originally going to use net worth, but the problem is, if we had to guess, probably most of the people don't know what their net worth is. People just don't track it. Why does that matter?
Well, that's another millionaire secret, is I say that millionaires, they watch their money like a hawk. And there's a quote, I don't know who says it, but it's just such a great quote when it comes to money. And it's that small leaks will sink big ships. And that's what happens with our money when we're not watching it. You know, the little Starbucks trips, or going through the convenience store, or just having happy hour with friends, or when we're not tracking our money, it just sort of floats through our fingers and we don't know where it's going. And all those little bitty money out swipes of credit cards, even if you pay it off, they start to add up. And that's, again, that's sort of that differential of robbing us of where we could be investing that money, saving that money, putting it towards something meaningful, yet versus just these little swipes. And since we're swiping the credit card, it's easier than ever to spend money and not pay attention to it. So you have to, you know, and there's another quote that says that where our attention goes, energy flows.
Yes.
And so it's just a principle. And again, that applies very much to money, that when we're attentive to our money, it tends to flow back to us, or we're moving it because it's intentional. But when we're not paying attention, money just floats away. So it's a principle that if you want to become a millionaire, you have to pay attention to your money. It needs time, it needs energy, it needs thought. You have to do some math to make important decisions, because the common sense with money basically just means that we're not going to have it.
I'm going to keep going back to when my income got slashed, because it's just the most relevant example I have of everything that you're sharing. But I remember, and I know I'm sharing this for a reason, because I think a lot of people here are using hope as a plan. And what I mean by that is, when my money got slashed, oh, it'll be fine. I'll have some big deals that'll come in. I'm working on this deal. Like, it's going to get better. And I kept hoping that things would change around. And I put all my focus on, oh, this will come in the future. But that wasn't really a great plan, because what I wasn't focusing on was all those Starbucks swipes, the going out to eat when we should have been staying in, analyzing what our fixed costs were versus our variable, until it got to the point where it's like, oh, the bank account's almost at zero. Now you actually have to do something and your back's up against the wall. And I think too many people are using hope as a plan.
Yeah, that's really well said. And it's sort of this underlying belief too, that the money will just figure it all itself out. If I can just make more money, if I can
it'll
just
work.
Keep this going, it'll work out.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
It all works out in the end. And even, you know, it sounds like you weren't really paying attention to it until your income got slashed. And it's what, you know, it's this holy cow moment of like, oh my God, then you're forced to pay attention. But, you know, I'd like to see people pay attention before the crisis.
Well, and this is where the accountability in me comes out. Even though I learned that hard lesson, I didn't make it a habit, because money started to shift, things got really good, you know, take up to where we are today. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at this, and Jay and I are talking about this. All right, how much are we going to put into reserves for the company? Like, that means foregoing money coming into my pocket, because we want the company to be in a position to reinvest the profits. And I'm sitting down with my wife going, honey, we got to be able to live off just salary. That means we got to make some changes to our lifestyle because we've allowed it to rise again. That's what I mean by the accountability side. And but she goes, well, can't you just go get a speaking gig? And it's like, no. And this is not throwing my wife under the bus because we have real conversations around this, but I want everybody who's listening to this to understand, like, I certainly still struggle with this. It's a reason why I'm having this conversation with Christina, because she's somebody who is certainly further ahead than me when it comes to financial intelligence and net worth. Therefore, I am trying to learn. And so I want everybody also to take an honest look in the mirror and say, all right, where do you need to make some changes? Where do you need to improve?
Yeah, and it happens to all of us. Remember, Parkinson's law is expenses will always rise to match income. So those expenses start creeping up even for all of us. And that's why the accountability, like you said, the standard practices, having certain goals and conversations with your significant other to make sure you're both on the same page. Because more money, I can spend more. It's just so natural. It's not like we're greedy or selfish or have to buy a lot of stuff. It's just really almost such natural human behavior that we don't realize it. So that's why, you know, my husband and I mean, we are very intentional with our money and looking at it a lot, but those things creep up and we wonder the same thing. We're like, how did we spend that much money? And it's like, no. I mean, we don't need to spend that. But anyway, it's not for anybody to beat themselves up. It's just very natural. And it just goes back to, you know, back to sort of the money principles that you have to watch your money. You have to really be thoughtful. And even with that, like what you're talking about. So on the business side, what you're talking about, what you and Jay were talking about is called retained earnings. And so you have retained earnings, which you leave in the company, which means as a business owner, like you said, you're not paying yourself that amount. So you're leaving many months of paychecks, and retained earnings is like a reserve bucket. And it's a reserve bucket for the business. So if you have a low revenue month or whatever, you can dip into the retained earnings so that you don't have to, you know, cut expenses and other things. It's kind of like what I say, call the your save your butt bucket.
Yeah.
So that's in business. Well, the same thing on the personal side. And for good financial, that's good financial practices on the small business side. It's required on the big business side. But in your personal account, that's what your rainy day bucket is, or what I call your reservoir bucket. It's your same thing as your retained earnings on the business side, but that's what you have to have on your personal side for the same thing, especially as an entrepreneur. This is what they don't teach in entrepreneur school. On the money side, is maybe you might even learn some business books over here, but on the personal books, you have to have the same quote unquote retained earnings, which is your rainy day. So that when your income months are low, because maybe the business had a lower than desirable profit month that you would bring over normally to your business, your personal side, you might dip into the rainy day. So the rainy day is the cover your butt bucket for entrepreneurs, so that when there is a dip, you can borrow and then pay yourself back. So you constantly, you can be dipping into that.
Well, that's what saved us when my income got slashed. I had 6 to 8 months liquid and we used it. All of it.
So what would have happened? Now, most people don't. So what would have happened had you guys not had that money sitting aside?
Would have had to sell our house, which, you know, from a net worth standpoint, I worked hard to be able to get a conventional loan to put 20% down. So I would have not had the principal payment when I wanted to buy my next house. Would have had to have sold our cars, probably gone to a one car family, moved from a really nice house down to an apartment with a family, you know. And again, there may be people who are listening to this who are like, I'm there right now. Like you said, what was once a luxury now becomes a necessity. We had gotten used to a certain standard of living. We were living a very nice standard of living. Would we have survived? Yes. Would it have been a really powerful lesson? Yes. I didn't need to go that far. Well, maybe I, because clearly my habits haven't corrected the way that they needed to. So who knows?
Well, I think, you know, you're just lucky because I think what I'm listening to you say, that life would have dramatically changed. It was probably already hard enough and making adjustments. And, you know, how do we change our lives now that the income has really dropped? But if you wouldn't have had that safety net, it could have caused all sort of havoc. It usually wreaks a lot of havoc. And everybody has emergencies. Life is life. Life happens. We don't know. I doubt you expected that your income was just going to be slashed out of the blue. We're not expecting maybe that we get into a car crash and we can't work for 6 months or something happens.
That your car gets totaled and that the insurance company isn't giving you enough to actually get a new car and now you have to go out of pocket to buy a new one. Oh yeah, that.
That situation, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, that. Okay, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, there's something I want to ask you before we wrap up, which you talked about the importance of watching your money like a hawk. Yet, and I'm hearing that, and I try to put myself in a listener's shoes who maybe doesn't understand how you watch your money like a hawk. I remember learning in one of our conversations about the importance of simplifying and streamlining where everything is. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, as a business owner, do you have to watch your money pretty closely?
Yes.
Are you and Jay, as a business partner, you guys talking about revenue, expenses, lowering cost of sale, trying to increase profit margins? I mean, I'm guessing you never talk about those things, right?
Only once a day.
Exactly. So with business, I mean, it's required. If you're going to have a profitable business, a business that grows, you're going to be focusing on how do we increase revenue? How do we hold cost of sales or expenses? And how do we manage expenses against sort of managing expenses? Because we have to spend money to make money and trying to find that balance. And ultimately, you guys pay yourselves off of profit. So not enough revenue, too high of expenses, no profit. So to be a, you know, to be a responsible business owner, you're in the books, you're asking those questions all the time. But, you know, I find so many of my clients that they do that in the business, but in their personal, they're not in those same practices. And sort of how the money moves is we move it from our earnings, from our business, and that profit that you're taking from your business after retained earnings, like you said, you're keeping these little tight so you can have that buffer, you're moving it over into your household account. So that's your personal income. But same thing, how you get rich, which means net worth. Some people bank just on their business profit. Maybe they have an exit, but that's very risky. If you look at the statistics of businesses that sell and then businesses that sell for even close to what they kind of banked on because all of their net worth sort of retirement strategy was in selling their business, it's very risky. So that can be maybe a backup plan, but the goal is just to use your business is to generate income for your household, and how you get rich is how you invest out of your household. So you're always looking at, okay, this amount of money came in, this percentage is what we want to make sure we invest, because you've set your goal based on, I want to become a millionaire or multiple of in a certain time frame. So what millionaires do that others don't is they do what I call reverse engineer. So where most people, the Joneses, as I call them, what they do is they have their income, they spend, and they hope to save and invest what's left over, but there's never anything left over. So they think, I'll worry about that in the future when I get more income, and the cycle continues. What millionaires do, they reverse engineer it. They say, okay, how much money do I need to invest on a monthly basis compounded over some period of time to become a net worth millionaire, let's say in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever that number is. And then they work backwards. But basically, let's say on a $50,000 income, which is around, I think, $4,200 a month. If you're looking at that $4,200 a month, you could say, okay, I want to be a millionaire in, let's say, 20 years, which would be $1,250 of the $4,200 that I need to, you know, shave off the top and invest over that 20 years so I can become a millionaire. And then I get to spend what's left over. So that's the way millionaires do it. That's why they millionaires spend less than they make. They focus on spending. They focus on what they keep so that they can invest. But you have to be looking at that all the time, especially as an entrepreneur or commissioned salesperson, because our incomes fluctuate. There's no such thing as an exact same profitable month every single month. So it's even more so that we watch the money. So when you say, how do you do that? It's just like you're doing with Jay. It's you do it with your spouse. Okay, how much money came in this month? All right. How much are we going to shave to invest to make sure we stay on track? How are we doing on track? What do we have on our balance sheet? You know, you have your business balance sheet, you have your personal balance sheet. Great, we're going to invest what's left over. I mean, we're going to spend what's left over. How's our spending doing? My God, the Starbucks crept back in. What if instead of spending $80 a month or $160 a month between the two of us on Starbucks, what if we put that into our investment? What if we just went out to eat one fewer time, because those to go out and eat in Austin, Texas these days, you can't go out to eat for less than $100. So you just start looking at the expenses because they start to creep up. And if you just do that once a month, your business, you're doing it usually much more often, but just once or twice a month is plenty in the personal. But the takeaway here is you have to look at your money. You have to be watching your spending. You have to make sure that you're on track. You need to kind of look at the trajectory of where you're headed, because if you don't, you're going to live paycheck to paycheck to paycheck for the rest of your life and never have what I call a freedom moment. Because Many times we think money's attached to consumption, buying stuff, certain status, certain emblems on our cars or our clothes. And that's fine as long as we're building towards freedom. And that's the goal. The goal of money and income is to buy freedom, because freedom is time. And then that's time, when we have financial freedom, we have time freedom to do whatever the hell we want. And that can be continue to work. It can be doing sitting on a beach. We get to choose which one it is. But that's what freedom is. It's not about retirement. It's not about necessarily, you know, some future moments better than the past, but it's about, what's my freedom number? And that's another thing millionaires know. They know what the freedom number is. They know basically what I call part of millionaire math is, there's a couple numbers you want to know. You want to know is, what's your freedom net worth number? And there's a real easy rule of thumb to figure some of these things out. I mean, it's not precise. Everybody needs to do it for their own situation. But just really good sort of rule of thumbs to use is that if we're looking at net worth, how much net worth is enough? Well, the net worth that's enough that we want to accumulate is a net worth that will throw off the amount of income in our future that will pay for the cost of our lifestyle. At which point, that freedom point is where the income from our assets pays for the cost of our lifestyle, so we don't have to work so hard. The money's working hard, our bodies aren't working hard. And that's what gives us our time freedom back. So we have to know how much that number is. And $1 million of net worth is approximately, you divide it by 20, is approximately $50,000. So the second number you need to know is your freedom income number. That's assuming if my house was paid off, my cars were paid off, I had no personal debt payments, how much could we comfortably live off of? If we made more, great, but life would be just fine. And let's pretend it's $50,000 a year. Then you multiply that by 20, and that means you need $1 million of net worth. So it's just some very easy millionaire math, and you adjust your expenses accordingly and just work towards staying on track. And then as your income goes up, you can throw much, your standard of living can go up a little bit, but then you can really amplify how much, you know, the timing, how much quicker that you could produce that freedom number, because ultimately that's what we want. We just want the freedom to be able to choose whether I'm going to go to work today or not.
That's right. That's right. Well, if somebody wanted to read some books, what have been some of the most powerful books for you in terms of your financial intelligence?
You know, there's some great ones, and it sounds like you've read them. I mean, timeless books that I think that everybody should read, that, you know, really give some of the basics that we all should have learned in middle school. But one is Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That's such a great one, especially teaching that, you know, millionaires are really, and they're not in the income game, they're in the asset game. And that's a big difference. It's caring about the assets, income to buy assets, because assets are future passive income. There is The Millionaire Next Door, which a lot of these sort of millionaire secrets come out of, is that they drive the old trucks. They don't really have to, you know, use money to buy status. You know, they know their numbers. There is Falling for Money, which is my book, so I like to put that one in the list. There's a really great book on millionaire mindset. I think it's called Millionaire Mindset, actually, because mindset's a good piece as well. Because if we don't feel like, you know, what I like to say is that no amount of money will fix the I'm not good enough psychology. So a lot of money hangups come from psychology, that maybe we can make it, but we spend it because of whatever reason.
I love it. I love it. Well, where can people learn more about you, Christina?
Well, I'm easy to find. Just Google Christina Wise. My business, my brand is Wealthy Wealthy. And if anybody wants some free money training, just go to howto.money, not .com, but .money, howto.money.
And Christina spells her name a little differently, and Wealthy Wealthy is also spelled differently. So look in the description below this and you'll see how we spell it. So make sure you can find her. Well, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Oh, I had a blast. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. My conversation with Christina Wise. You know, this money conversation, it is something that is just so near and dear to my heart. I mean, for those of you who have ever suffered a massive pay cut or a devastating job loss, or who understand what it's like to wonder if you're going to be able to pay your bills, you feel like you're not in control. The truth is, however, you've always had the opportunity to be in control of your life. You've always had the opportunity to be in control of your finances. You simply relinquished it. You relinquished it to a series of bad habits, and actions over time that led to you adopting a certain standard of living that you tell yourself the story you can't live without. And believe me, I'm looking in the mirror as I share this with you. It's part of the reason why I love doing this podcast, is because by no means am I the expert. I am the student just as much as you are, but it's a real opportunity for us together to surround ourselves with some really great minds and then be able to have that internal accountability conversation and ask the question, how can I be doing better? How can I do better? You know, when she was talking about staying close to your money, one of the things I didn't share that I'll share with you now is the importance of enlisting the support of your significant other, your partner. This is just speaking from personal experience. I feel like I have a very high level of financial intelligence. However, and I can know exactly where we are. I know where our net worth is down to the penny on a weekly basis. I know what our credit card numbers are. I know everything. However, does my wife know that? Because she still has to go out and buy groceries. She still has spending habits, but I realized I have not done a good enough job effectively communicating our financial position with my wife, whether it's a great position or one that needs much improvement. But the responsibility falls to me, because if I can be in control of my finances or I can be out of control. And the person that goes to blame, that goes to shame, that goes to justification about why it is the way it is, those are the people who are relinquishing control. I refuse to be that person. I hope you will refuse to be that person. And if you want to be in control of your finances, if you want to be in control of your future prospects, look in the mirror and accept accountability and start taking some actions. She suggested to you at the end that you should know your freedom net worth number. What is that dollar amount that you would need to live off of? And this came up in conversation with Jay Papazan the other day, where he said, you know, my wife and I determined a long time ago that if all our debt was paid off, no mortgage, no car payments, no credit card debt, we could easily live a really nice lifestyle off 75 grand a year. Well, if you take 75 grand and you want to find out what's that net worth number that I need to get to so that could throw it off. I mean, take 75 grand divided by 0.04. I'm doing this with you right now. You know, that's a little under $2 million, just under $1.9 million. That may sound like a lot of money to you. That may sound like not a lot of money to you. But the truth is, identify the number and put a plan in place and start working the plan. So hopefully this episode has added value to you. Finances is one of the seven circles, is one of the most important buckets in your life. So what's the one thing you can do for your finances such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary? And we challenge you to begin taking action. So with that, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. If you are not subscribed to the show yet, please go ahead and click that subscribe button. It'll make sure that all future episodes automatically come to your device. And if you are newer to the show and you have not been with us since the beginning, go back to the beginning and come all the way through, because it has been a journey, and it will be a journey that we will continue to go on together for years to come. And if you have not left us a review yet in iTunes, please do so. We love reading your comments. Your endorsement really says a lot to other people who consider, am I going to invest my most valuable resource, my time, in this show? So thank you to all of you who are subscribers and to all of you who have left us a review. You mean the world to us. Thanks, and we'll see you in the next episode.